I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. Do you believe that most people only think about themselves and are not interested in helping others? That the only reason someone is honest is not because of the goodness of their heart, but because they're afraid of getting caught? Our guest, psychologist Jamil Zaki, says this kind of cynicism is harmful to your mental and physical health. He's a professor of psychology and head of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab at Stanford University, where researchers are studying connection and caring. He's also the author of a new book titled Hope for Cynics and a self-described recovering cynic. While it's easy and understandable to feel cynical these days, Zaki says there's another way to deal with our mistrust of human beings. He calls it hopeful skepticism, acting like a scientist by looking at evidence before deciding if someone is trustworthy or not. Zaki also says there are enduring myths about cynicism, imagining the worst in people that get us in trouble. He joins us on The Connection today to talk about why people are probably better than we think. And Jamil Zaki, nice to have you with us on the show.
It's great to be here, Marty.
Well, let's begin with you, because you say on the very first page of this book that you are a cynic, a recovering cynic. And you also describe in some detail about growing up in a kind of chaotic family with parents who did not get along. Help us understand how you became cynical.
That's right, Marty. As you know, have spent my entire career studying some form of human goodness, caring, connection, empathy, and kindness. And so there's this stereotype that what you study must be the way that you live. Hmm. In psychology, we call it research is me-search.
That's right. So, exactly.
So a lot of people assume that because I study this sunny side of human nature, I must just have the sunniest disposition imaginable. But as I reveal in the book, the truth has sometimes been the opposite. As you said, I grew up in a home that was a little bit difficult. My parents are both wonderful people and did their very best. They're both immigrants from different countries, my father from Pakistan and my mother from Peru. And they really don't have much in common. I don't really know why they got together, except that they were both felt maybe uncomfortable in the U.S. at first, but they've now been here for over 50 years. And I think as they grew more comfortable in the country, they realized just how little they wanted to be together. So a lot of my childhood was spent as the only child of two people who didn't really like each other. And that environment ended up, I think, making it relatively difficult for me to trust people. That sort of gave me a keen eye for distress and conflict, and generally left me with a somewhat gloomy disposition. So this secret the entire time has been that I study goodness, I talk about it, but in my private life, I do tend towards cynicism, as you said.
Well, and it sounds like, and it makes sense when you think about it, that cynicism as a form of protection, as you say, cynics are not made, they are not born, they're made. I mean, something happens to create that level of cynicism. But I wonder whether it is a form of protection, which is to, people are going to disappoint you, so maybe it's better off to be cynical.
That's very wise. And, you know, as we talk about cynicism and cynics today, I just want to be really clear that for me, this is not a judgmental conversation.
Right.
I don't want people who feel cynical to be judged at all. I mean, I'm right there with you. And Marty, to your point, I do think that oftentimes cynicism feels safe and is a response to people feeling unsafe. The way I describe it is that if you are betrayed or hurt, which most people are at some point in their lives, you can easily be disappointed. That is, lowering your expectations of the person who hurt you, or maybe even the environment in which you were hurt. When this becomes cynicism is when we become re-disappointed. That is, lowering our expectations of everyone in order to not be hurt again. And I think cynics often do that. They feel as though, well, the only way for me to be safe is to never count on anybody. The problem is that although that might keep you safe from obvious betrayals in the short term, in the long term, that is an extraordinarily dangerous way to live because it shrinks the aperture of your life. It loses you connections and flourishing, and ultimately leads to ill health in all sorts of different ways.
In fact, loneliness, you say, is one of the biggest prices of being cynical.
Absolutely. If you are cynical, and maybe we can define that term.
Sure.
You know, cynicism is this general idea that overall, at our core, humanity is selfish, greedy, and dishonest. And if you believe that, then acts of trust, putting our faith in other people, seem like a bet for suckers. You know, it just seems like a terrible idea. But without trust, without vulnerability, it's impossible to build the relationships that matter most to us, whether those are friendships or collaborations at work or true love. And so in the absence of vulnerability, what you see is that cynics live a life of general disconnection when compared to non-cynics. And that loneliness over time can be psychologically poisonous.
Well, I have certainly been selfish, greedy, and dishonest, I think, as we all have been. And I also think it's really easy to look around the world and to see the level of suffering in the world, frankly, of the kind of hurtful and hateful behavior that we see in the world. And one could use that as evidence that we should not trust people because they're untrustworthy.
I completely resonate with that. And again, I imagine listeners thinking the same thing and saying, mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute, I watch the news. There are terrible things happening all over the place every day. And that is absolutely true. The question is whether those pieces of news, the harm that is truly done every day, is the best representation of our species or not. Cynicism is the decision that the worst things we do are the best evidence about who we are. But I would say that in many cases, they're not, and certainly are not the only pieces of evidence we can use when we consider what people are really like. Oftentimes, we have what psychologists call negativity bias. That is, we focus much more on threatening and harmful information than on the good stuff. And again, maybe this helps us in certain ways. You can imagine 200,000 years ago, paying attention to predators could keep you alive. And maybe now, if you're in a dangerous situation, it's good to pay attention to threats, or at least useful. But what I think has happened now is that this ancient bias towards the negative has been combined with a hyper-modern media ecosystem that feeds us so much negative information that it's easy for us to end up looking at only half of the equation of human life and making sweeping generalizations that might actually not just be cynical, but also be inaccurate.
Well, as you said, you have been studying goodness and kindness for some two decades now. But also, I get this sense that you have some, if not hopelessness and despair about the world, but that you have some worry about the world that we're in as well. And how much do you think that is driven by social media or just our appetite for the news and our ability to find bad news stories?
I think it's both, right? So there can be truth in our gloomy assumptions or our gloomy conclusions, and there can be bias. I'll say that before writing this book, I was much more hopeless. I felt like maybe people weren't so great. I felt like despite what I knew scientifically, I couldn't trust other people. And I thought that the future looked dim in a number of different ways. What I learned in researching this book is A, more people feel like that than ever. I mean, we are living in a cynicism boom. But B, that oftentimes this comes not again from things getting worse, but from the media representations that we see. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Researchers talk about something called mean world syndrome. That's the idea that the more you tune into the news, whether through cable news or social media, the worse you think things are and the worse you think people are. Now, one response to this would be, yeah, of course, if you're tuning into the news, you're more informed. Sometimes tuning in actually makes us less informed. One example is that people who watch lots of cable news tend to imagine that violent crime is on the rise. I remember when I was growing up in the 1980s, every milk carton would have a picture of a kidnapped child. And so the idea was that kidnapping was rampant around the entire U.S. In both cases, of course, any violent crime and any kidnapping are tragic events that we need to pay attention to. But in both cases, the more you tune in, the more you overestimate how much those things are occurring. In fact, kidnapping by strangers is exceedingly rare, and violent crime has gone down across the country for the last three decades. But these are positive trends and pieces of data that we don't see on the news. So the more we tune in, the less we know about how rare those negative events are, and the less we pay attention, again, to the good stuff.
I think that's why a lot of people are taking a break from the news, because they don't want to feel this way.
100%. And, you know, there's evidence that taking a break, at least from social media, for 4 weeks, actually can improve our mental health, in some cases as much as going to therapy.
Let me pick up on something that you referenced here, but having to do with cynicism. And you say there are basically three obvious myths about cynicism, that people who are cynical are smarter and cleverer than the rest of us. People who are cynical feel safer in the world, and that there's something moral about being cynical as well. Can you deconstruct that for us?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about the second of those myths, that cynicism is safe, but let's talk about the first and third.
Sure.
So the first is what researchers call the cynical genius illusion. So it turns out that if you ask people who will be better at these tasks, somebody who is cynical and suspicious of others, or somebody who is trusting, 70% of people say that cynics would be smarter than non-cynics. 85% of people think that cynics are socially smarter. For instance, that they'll be better at spotting liars than non-cynics. So in essence, most of us put our faith in people who don't have much faith in people. try to say that three
right.
times
no,
fast.
I hear you.
But most of us are wrong. It turns out that data from hundreds of thousands of people demonstrate that cynics do less well on cognitive tests than non-cynics, and they also are worse at spotting liars than non-cynics. And so, again, we are completely backwards in our perceptions, and you might ask, well, why? To me, this is because cynicism often appears wise. It has the kind of cultural cachet of a snarky person who's been around the block and doesn't have time for people's nonsense. But in fact, cynicism is not a type of wisdom. It's an assumption. Cynics have very little faith in other people, but they have tons of faith in their own intuitions, right? They believe that everyone's terrible, which is such a sweeping conclusion. You would have to be extremely confident to hold that belief. So cynics end up not really paying attention to the data about what each person is giving them, what each situation is like. And as a result, they end up not learning as much about the world.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Jamil Zaki. He's a psychologist, and he's got a brand new book, Hope for Cynics, subtitled The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with psychologist Jamil Zaki. He was just talking about some of the myths of cynicism, and he's got a new book we've been talking about called Hope for Cynics, and he is the head of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab at Stanford University, where he is a professor of psychology. Picking up on what you were saying, and even going back to the book, as you say, cynicism, I'm quoting you here, wears away the psychological glue that binds us. So if you don't trust people, if you only see the kind of badness in people, you know, then why would you want to be in relationship with people if they're only going to disappoint you or maybe even hurt you?
That's right. And, you know, this is true at the level of individuals. You find that cynical people, for instance, are less willing to open up to the folks in their lives, less likely to ask for support. They're also less likely to give others support. So there's this, you know, I almost sometimes think of cynicism as a social form of depression.
Hmm.
You know, somebody who's suffering from depression might come to sweeping negative conclusions about themselves. I'm worthless. Nobody likes me. And then they might make decisions based on that. You know, I think I'm just going to stay home. I don't think I'm going to apply for that job. And eventually, the depression becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It convinces us of who we are, and then we live life according to its claims. Cynicism, I think, does the same thing in the social world. It starts with these broad, sweeping, often unsupported claims about what other people are like, and cynics end up, again, withdrawing, deciding, well, I don't want to trust that person. I don't want to connect with that person. And the problem is that that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. As we've talked about, cynics end up lonelier. But, you know, it's also true that when we treat people cynically, they can tell. And
sure.
They end up reacting. And oftentimes what we do inadvertently is bring out other people's most selfish side. If you treat somebody like they're out for themselves, if you don't give them a chance to show their values, well, then you might end up turning them into the folks that you fear instead of the people you hope they might be.
In fact, you say cynics see problems, they don't see solutions, leading them to being less engaged with the world, less engaged with other people.
That's right. And this is true at the level of individual relationships, but it's also true at the level of our society. You know, since I started working on this set of problems and ideas, I hear from a lot of people who say something along the lines of, yeah, hope, that's cute. It's great for somebody like you. You're privileged. You're a professor at a fancy university. You know, I can't afford to have hope. I need to be cynical. Or that cynicism is a way of focusing on real problems and hope is a way of ignoring them. It turns out that, as you're saying, cynics do see problems in our world. And my goodness, there are so many. But they think that those problems represent who we really are. And if you think that a broken system or an unjust policy reflects human nature, why bother trying to change it? So cynics, in addition to withdrawing from relationships, also tend to withdraw from civic life. They vote less often and protest less often and take part in social movements less often than less cynical individuals. So cynicism often feels like a radical approach to the world, but actually, in many cases, it's a tool of the status quo instead.
You call for something that you describe as hopeful skepticism, not cynicism, but hopeful skepticism. Put those two words together. What does that mean for you and for us?
Yes, that's a great question. So let's start with the second, skepticism. Skepticism is often confused with cynicism, but they're quite different from one another. I often think of it this way. A cynic is like a lawyer in the prosecution against humanity, right? They're looking for evidence that supports what they already believe, that people are pretty terrible, and they hyper-focus on that evidence and dismiss or ignore evidence about human goodness. A skeptic is not like a lawyer. They're like a scientist. They don't assume people are terrible, but they don't assume everybody's wonderful as well. They're not naive Pollyannas. Instead, they look for evidence from each person, from each situation, and decide who they can trust and who they can't. So that type of skepticism is a much more adaptable, sharp, and ultimately wise way of moving through the social world. The hopeful piece of hopeful skepticism is acknowledging that most of us spend a lot of time thinking about the bad side and focused on negativity. And as a result, when we adopt skepticism, when we pay closer attention to what people are really like, pleasant surprises will be everywhere. The data are clear. People tend to be more trustworthy, more generous, more open-minded, and warmer than we think they are. The average person underestimates the average person.
The average person underestimates the average person. I like that. You know, I've always struggled with the word hope. Maybe you and I have different definitions. I mean, for me, it's it's associated with wishful thinking or crossing my fingers and hoping that something good is going to happen. Whereas I feel like the word faith, not in the religious sense, but just the ability to act and react when we're faced with uncertainty, that that's an even more powerful way of interacting with the world. What do you think about that?
I think a lot of people have slightly different definitions of these terms. And so I think that we might have very similar ideas and just be using these words in different ways. I mean, I can tell you the way that psychologists define and think about some of these terms, which I agree are interrelated. The way that you're talking about hope is how I would talk about optimism and how other researchers would talk about optimism. Optimism is the belief that the future will turn out well. And optimistic people tend to be happy, but they can also be somewhat complacent. And I think this is what you're getting at, right? Just kind of crossing your fingers, waiting for good things to happen. And because of that, optimists can also be disappointed pretty easily. I think of optimism as a more fragile view of the future, because if things don't turn out rosy, well, then what happened? Something's wrong with the entire world. By contrast, the way that psychologists see hope is as the belief that the future could turn out well. Now, I know that's a small distinction, but I think it's really crucial. The future could turn out well, but we don't know what will happen. In that uncertainty, there's room for our actions to matter. So when researchers study hope, they often think of it as having different parts. One is the ability to envision a future you want. Two is the ability to envision a path towards that future. And three is taking steps along that path. I don't know what you think, Marty, but to me that seems much more like a practical, action-oriented emotion and less like just crossing your fingers.
No, I appreciate that distinction, and I agree with you. I think we're actually talking about the same thing. But I do think when you boil it down is that, you know, we don't know the future. You know, we sort of act with the assumption that either things will turn out okay or maybe they won't turn out okay. But we can't sit home idly by doing nothing. So anyway, for me, it's about our willingness to engage with the world without all the information that gives us hope, to use your word.
I completely agree. And here's a place where I think optimists and cynics actually have a lot in common. If you think you know what will happen,
right,
and it's good, you don't have to do anything.
Right.
If you think you know what will happen and it's going to be terrible, you don't have to do anything either. I think that it's hard. It's hard cognitive and emotional labor to admit how little we know about the future. We want to know, even if what we know is terrible. There's a dark satisfaction in that. Hopeful skepticism requires us to let go of that satisfaction and embrace humility and uncertainty. But again, in that, there's also empowerment. So hopeful people, unlike optimists or cynics, do tend to take more action in trying to shape the future because they think those actions, again, could matter.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's psychologist Jamil Zaki, our guest today on The Connection. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Hope for Cynics, and it's subtitled The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. You mentioned this earlier, and the book is a lot about sort of approaching relationships almost like a scientist. But I wonder, are we built for that? I mean, we are thinking people, but we are feeling people as well. And sometimes it's hard to separate the two in trying to figure out whether someone is trustworthy or not.
This is a huge part of my thinking, and actually goes beyond just any, you know, this book or any one part of our psychology. We are full of instincts. Human beings are packed with instincts, some of which help us and some of which don't. And you're right, we are thinking and feeling people, and it's easy to let our intuitions and instincts take over. But I think that we do not need to do that, and in many cases, we need to avoid doing that. You know, so we have instincts that tell us not to trust people because we focus on negative information. We also have instincts to prefer people who are our own race over people who are a different race. we have an instinct to judge people more harshly when if we're hungry than if we've just had lunch. Huh. It would be ridiculous to say, well, this is my gut or this is the vibe I get, so I'm going to make a decision based on that. And again, it's hard work. And I would say that it's an uphill climb to swap out cynicism for hopeful skepticism. But a lot of what we do is hard work. Staying in good physical shape is hard work. Studying mathematics is hard work. And I think that, you know, the nun and author Pema Chodron, one of my favorite writers, talks about contemplative practice as treating life like an experiment, giving it more attention, working harder on our perceptions and our actions. And I think that, you know, given all the effort that we put in at work and in the various problems we're trying to solve, we should put in at least some of that effort to sculpting and cultivating the types of minds and reactions that we want, not just the ones that nature gives us.
But are you talking about data? I mean, I think of science and research is a lot about data and proving theses, you know, whether they're true or not, that we need to collect data about the world and then make decisions about whether we think it's a safe place or not, or whether someone is a safe person or not.
That's beautifully put. And yes, that's exactly what I think we can do. Not just as scientists, but as people, we can be curious in the way that scientists are and enterprising in the way that scientists are as well. You know, we've talked about the link between cynicism and depression, right, or the parallels at least. One of the best treatments for depression is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is in essence where a therapist asks patients to think about themselves more like scientists. Hey, you said earlier that you feel like you're totally worthless. That's a pretty big claim. What evidence do you have for that? Right? And so fact-checking our depressed feelings, our cynical feelings, is a great starting point for thinking more and acting more like a scientist. A second step is what I call taking leaps of faith on people. Now, this is not recklessly, you know, believing what everybody says at a poker table or giving your car keys to a stranger. But it's small and calculated risks that we can take where we show our faith in other people and give them a chance to show us who they are. And then if we pay attention, we can use what they give us back as data. You know, one example of this is talking to strangers. People vastly underestimate how positive conversations with strangers will be. I myself did,
you did that
until,
right,
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt that way. I'm pretty introverted, but I tried to do an experiment last year. I went to on a quick business trip to North Carolina, and I decided that I would force myself to talk with every stranger where there was a reasonable opportunity to start a conversation. And, you know, I know about the research. I know that people underestimate how good conversations will be. And yet I was completely full of that bias myself. I mean, I was terrified. I got on this plane and this guy sits next to me, very nice seeming guy. And I thought, oh, man, I'm going to be that person who tries to make awkward small talk. And then the person next to you puts their headphones on. It's
right,
just a disaster.
Exactly.
And we had this just lovely, brilliant conversation. This is a refugee from North Africa who was here, and I just learned so much about his life, and it was just this beautiful conversation. And I had 8 more conversations over the course of this 2-day-long trip, and look, they weren't all as delightful as the first one, but none of them were bad, and many of them were very good. And I thought to myself, wow, if I am surprised by this research as somebody who does it, right, if I can't internalize this, well, we all need to do maybe more work to try to collect this data and learn from it, to stop relying again on our assumptions and our intuitions, and to start actually paying attention. Because again, when we do, people often exceed our expectations and assumptions about them.
You write about an experiment that the Toronto Star ran, and they had, I guess, members of their journalistic staff drop something like 20 wallets around the city. It had some money inside and some business cards. And you ask, so how many of those wallets were returned? 80% of them were returned rather than someone stealing the money and just tossing the wallet in the trash. What does that tell us?
Well, I guess, not to answer a question with a question, Marty, but I wonder, before you learned that 80% figure, what would your guess have been?
Right. Not 80%. It might have been 40 to 50%. I tend to be, you know, pretty optimistic about people. So I would be closer to like half and half.
Yeah, I would have as well. I would have probably guessed 40%. The average Torontonian guessed 25% of these wallets would be returned. And this to listeners who are saying, well, come on, it's Canada. That's like easy mode for
those
for
nice
human
Canadians. Yes.
they're just too busy being polite. But no, this experiment was then replicated around the world. And although rates of return were not always as high as they were in Toronto, they tended to be greater than 50% and in many places reached around 80%. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's two pieces of data there. One, there is a lot of human goodness around. People's everyday instincts tend to be pretty pro-social. And two, we don't see that. Another really, to me, more dramatic case of this is disasters. You know, for decades, social scientists have found that there are two stories around disasters. One is the story you see in the news or in movies, which is that when there's an attack or a hurricane or whatever, people fall apart. They act selfishly. They panic. They look out only for themselves. It's like a return to nature where nature is red in tooth and claw and just chaotic and a sort of battle royale. But if you look at the historical record after disasters, people bring out their kindest. I mean, after Hurricane Katrina, people went out on boats and rescued their neighbors. After 9/11, donations and volunteering shot up around the country. And during the pandemic, kindness in the form of volunteering, helping strangers, and donations to charity increased around the world for years. And again, here's where our cultural stories diverge from the data. And I think this is where cynicism gets the best of us. It's easy to remain stuck in our cynical, gloomy narratives about each other, even when in the shadows, in their quiet ways, people around the world are doing their best to be there for one another. So a question of my book, and I think the goal of Hopeful Skepticism, is can we bring that goodness out into the light and witness it more clearly?
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about the political partisan divide that we are living through now, which I think is connected to what we've been talking about. And again, our guest is psychologist Jamil Zaki. He's got a new book. It's called Hope for Cynics, and it's subtitled The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. And he is a professor of psychology at Stanford University, where he heads up the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And our guest is psychologist Jamil Zaki, author of a new book we've been talking about. It's titled Hope for Cynics, The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. Right before the break, you were talking about how we really underestimate the goodness in each other, which makes me think that we have a kind of tribal mindset. It's us against them, or it's you against me. Is that, do you think, operating in our psychology?
Oh, absolutely, and pervasively. And it's getting worse. So in 1980... people across the aisle, people liked members of their own group, Democrats and Republicans, and they felt pretty neutral about folks they disagreed with. By 2020, people disliked people they disagreed with more than they liked those on their own side. So not only are we polarized and have this us and them mentality ideologically, that division has become more personal and more emotional over time.
You have brought Republicans and Democrats together in a lab, I guess, just to see if they can find some common ground. How did that go?
Shockingly well.
I guess we shouldn't be shocked, right?
Well, here's the thing. You know, in our lab and in many other labs, there's evidence that, yes, we disagree, and I don't want to minimize the real disagreement, and I would say even in many cases the very dangerous disagreements in our country. I think there are real threats in our politics, and I'm the last person to say that there aren't. But that said, the division between the average Democrat and the average Republican is greater in our minds than it is in reality. So if you ask people on either side, what's the average person on the other side like? They think that that person is more extreme, more hateful, more anti-democratic, and even more violent than people on the other side, the average person on the other side, actually is. We all see representations of extremists in the media, and when we don't have contact with real people we disagree with, we assume that they're all extremists. To your question, in our lab, we decided to see, well, what happens if you just get people together? We had people join these calls on Zoom, and they talked about gun control, climate change, and abortion. I mean, these are real difficult issues.
Yeah.
Yep. And we asked them beforehand, hey, how do you think this conversation is going to go? What do you think the outcome will be? And their predictions ranged from neutral to negative. They either thought, well, this will do nothing, or it will make me feel worse about the other side. After the conversations, we asked them how well it had gone on a 1 to 100 scale, where 1 is the worst imaginable and 100 is the best that it could have gone. And the most common response we got was a 100 out of 100.
Wow.
People loved these conversations. They were shocked by how open-minded and reasonable somebody who they disagreed with could be. Now, that's not to say that they ended up agreeing. Most people didn't. But they at least saw the humanity on the other side of this issue.
You have some ideas about how to disagree better. Good disagreeers ask questions instead of making statements. They work to get underneath people's opinions to their stories. When they spot common ground, good disagreeers name it. When they are unsure of something, they say so rather than pretending to be confident. Is that what they did? And is that how they sort of ended up maybe not changing each other's minds, but at least not hating each other's guts?
Yeah, I mean, this is that recipe is a great one for people to adopt if they have a disagreement. We were surprised as researchers at how well people naturally adopt that recipe when they're in an open conversation. I should say, the people in our study thought that these conversations would go poorly, but so did we. We were terrified. I mean, as researchers, we want to learn about people, but we also want to protect them. So we had all of these, you know, contingency plans in place in case people started threatening each other or swearing at each other. We were wrong as well. But no, it turns out that when you get people in front of another human being, oftentimes what happens naturally is we become curious about one another. I'm not saying that always happens.
Right.
And maybe in a Zoom conversation, we set up conditions for people to actually try and learn about one another. But the conditions were not very hard to set up. We didn't give these people training in, you know, empathic communication or anything. They just did it on their own. So I think that when we can, again, just have a face-to-face human conversation, I'm not saying that we'll fix everything,
right,
but what I am saying is that it can be shocking how positively it goes and how much humanity there is underneath what people believe. People have stories. They have lives underneath their opinions. And even though you might disagree with somebody, knowing the story about how they got there can be really helpful in discovering common ground. And even when you don't, at least finding mutual respect.
Well, let me ask you about immigration, because you have a graph here in the book, and also we know about how, frankly, former President Trump and his vice presidential candidate, Vance, how they talk about migrants. I mean, frankly, the kind of pernicious lies about migrants. I'm assuming these are the kind of dangerous disagreements that you were talking about. But looking at this graph, is that there is so much overlap between the far left and the far right, and I guess it's mostly people in the middle, when it comes to consensus on migration. It's an issue we have not been able to solve, obviously, but it's so interesting to see this disconnect, but also to see how much we have in common.
Yeah, the data that you're talking about were collected by my late friend and somebody you've had on your show, the inspiration in many ways for my book, Emile Bruneau.
Sure.
Emile was really interested in why people hate and how we might overcome hatred. And one of his big insights was that we're often just wrong about other people, about who they are and about what they believe. So he and some collaborators asked people, Democrats and Republicans, how much would you want immigration to be sort of restricted or opened? So where zero is, I want all borders closed, and 100 is, I want all borders opened. And then he asked them, what do you think the average person on the other side feels? So if you're a Democrat, how would the average Republican answer this? And and vice versa. And what he found is two landscapes. So the landscape of people's real opinions is like a hill with two peaks. Democrats want a little bit more openness than Republicans, but they're all sort of clustered pretty close to the middle of this 1 to 100 scale. But in our minds, the reality is nothing like that, right? So if you ask Democrats, what does a Republican think? They think Republicans are all near zero, that they want the border totally closed. And if you ask Republicans, what do Democrats want? They think that they want almost completely open borders. So we're talking past each other because I think of the way that media represents each side. You know, you were talking about the things that the Republican ticket has been saying about immigration. There's a lot of research on what are known as conflict entrepreneurs. These are people who stoke conflict and try to get people to be scared of one another because it benefits them. And I think in many cases, elites, including politicians and including the two politicians we're talking about, make it their job to overemphasize and, in fact, I would say lie about how extreme the other side is, in order to scare the people on their own side and make them want to vote for them, right? So there are many cases in which our sort of phantom disagreements, what we would call false polarization, is not just a product of our mind, but is actually orchestrated by people who benefit when Americans, in this case, or people are more divided.
Let me quote something you quote in the book, and this is Martin Luther King. This was a speech he actually gave to the American Psychological Association in 1967, where he says, "There are some things in our society, some things in our world, to which we should never be adjusted." And he talked about discrimination and segregation and bigotry and militarism and physical violence. And then he called for something that he described as the International Association for the Advancement of Creative
Maladjustment.
Maladjustment. I scribbled through my writing ear. Let me say that correctly. The International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. What was he talking about? It's really intriguing.
Yeah, so Martin Luther King here sharing, I think, a really devastating, although very polite, critique of psychology at the time. I mean, and it's one that you could even level against us now. You know, psychologists are really interested in well-being. I'm interested in well-being, and I try to generate interventions that help people be happier, for instance. But MLK basically said, well, wait a minute. Why should people be happy in a world full of bigotry, injustice, inequality, and violence? We should not be well adjusted to these circumstances. It's the circumstances that are the problem, not our lack of well-being. Instead, he said, as you rightly quoted, that we should be creatively maladjusted. That is, dissatisfied, even furious with the status quo, but, and this is the creative part, but focused on how we and others can make a positive difference. And this is where I would say creative maladjustment and hopeful skepticism go hand in hand. So it turns out that researchers have studied what leads to collective action, what gets people off of their couch, off of their phones, and into the world, protesting, lobbying, you know, doing direct actions, voting, right? What gets them to try to make change? And it turns out there are two psychological ingredients that matter. One is anger, right? If you're not angry, if you're just happy with how things are, you probably won't do much. But the other is what's known as efficacy. That is our belief that we can change, that things can get better. Sounds a lot like hope, actually. And if you have anger, but you're not efficacious, if you think things are terrible, but there's nothing I can do, well, guess what? That's cynical. And then you end up not actually taking much action. So I think that this idea of creative maladjustment from Martin Luther King is like 50 years ahead of its time, at least. and we're discovering that the wisdom that he had here, that in order to make change, we need to both not have faith in how things are now, but have faith in people in general, and know that many of us want a world that is more peaceful, egalitarian, and sustainable. And when we see the good in each other now, then we can fight more fiercely for the future that most of us want.
It reminds me of the late Congressman John Lewis talking about good trouble. I mean, it's sort of related to what Martin Luther King was talking about.
100%. Yes, I love that connection.
Let me ask you about, I guess, the sort of downside of hope, if I can put it that way. You write, it might be the sweetener that helps oppression go down easier. This is the misapplication of hope and how that can be destructive and be wrong.
I think that's right. And I worry a lot about this, of course, again, sure. In writing about hope, in saying that we should be anti-cynical, I never want to draw people away from paying attention to real problems in their lives and in the world. The idea of hope is not to say things are great and I'm just going to ignore, right? I'm going to go from ignoring the positive half of the world's equation to ignoring the negative half. That would be just as harmful as cynicism. But I do think that there can be a practical, hard-boiled hope that we use, again, not to be satisfied with how things are, but to locate the people in our lives and in the world who want things to be better. The great writer Rebecca Solnit wrote, and I'm gonna paraphrase here, I hope I get it right. She said, hope is not a lottery ticket that you scratch and sit with on the couch trying to feel lucky. It's an axe that you break down doors with in an emergency. And I really take that to heart.
Well, in fact, I opened to that page because I thought it was so powerful and kind of speaks to what you are talking about. As you mentioned, you are a recovering cynic. How is your recovery going?
It's ongoing. I think it's funny. Here I am, right, in 2020 when I started this project, deeply cynical, and then deciding to spend years marinating myself in the science of hopelessness and suspicion. you might think that would have made matters worse. It's made things a lot better. I feel much more hopeful than I did before. Not optimistic, mind you, but hopeful. And I think it's because I've learned over and over again that the science is clear. Cynicism is not just something that makes us feel worse and withdraw from society. It's often just a cognitive error. It's a mistake. It's a lack of attention to what people are really like. So through this book and through the process of writing it, I've tried to be more aware of where my attention is going. I try to be more aware when I go online or watch the news at how my attention is being pulled, how it's being pulled towards my fear, and whether I might not be hearing the whole story. And I'm much more mindful in my everyday life to try to notice, I guess, as Mr. Rogers would say, the helpers. Look for the helpers. And I find that as I've opened or popped up this antenna in my mind where I look more for positive actions, for kindness, for generosity, and for warmth, My goodness, it is not hard to find. It's everywhere when you start to look. It's almost like taking this gloomy lens off and seeing each other more clearly. And that's helped me enormously.
We're almost out of time here, but do you have then, in 30 seconds or less, a different view of human nature?
No, I don't think I've ever known that. I don't think there's any answer to, are human beings good or bad, for instance. I didn't know the answer to that before, but I think I let my instincts carry me towards a negative place. Now I feel less certain, but I'm more comfortable with that uncertainty and more open to what the world and humanity has to show me.
Well, on that note, Jamil Zaki, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. A really fascinating conversation.
This has been totally delightful, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, his book is titled Hope for Cynics, and it's subtitled The Surprising Science of Human Goodness. He's a professor of psychology and head of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab at Stanford University. And thank you for joining us on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on the new WHYY app. You can follow us on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Also, check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Again, thanks for joining us.